going to be talking about drugs and drug use on today's morning show, but in a very out-of-the-ordinary way, courtesy of a fascinating new book called Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. In this book, author Sam Kelly examines 40 historical figures who, for one reason or another, utilized drugs. In some cases, we're talking about stories of drug abuse, of using drugs in self-destructive ways. In other cases, we're talking about using drugs in ways that were necessary and very much beneficial to the person in question and allowing them to achieve what they went on to achieve in their lives. There is a wide array of historical figures here, ranging from world leaders like Alexander the Great and Queen Victoria, to artists like William Shakespeare and Vincent van Gogh, to industrial leaders like Howard Hughes and Steve Jobs. Some stories are not a surprise at all, such as the stories of Elvis Presley or Judy Garland, although Sam Kelly manages to shed light on these familiar stories. And other people will be a huge surprise, such as the father of our country, George Washington, or Pope Leo XIII, for whom our current pope is named. The story of how drugs figured into their lives is utterly fascinating. Sam Kelly, a passionate student of history, is a recent graduate of Stanford University, and this is his first book, Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence, published by Plume, a division of Penguin Random House. Sam Kelly, we welcome you to the morning show. I am excited to speak with you.
It is great to be here. I'm excited to talk to you.
So I am so anxious to know how you got the idea for doing this. And I guess in particular, how did you know that this subject matter would be a rich enough vein to explore? I mean, that there was a book here. How did you come to understand that?
Yes, so I've always been incredibly driven by my love of history and my love of storytelling, especially. So I graduated with a degree in history from Stanford, but ever since I was a little kid, I would go to my teacher and ask to take home the teacher's edition of the textbook when I was in elementary school so I could read the extra stuff on the side that provided more context and discussion questions and stuff like that. And my mom would come in the morning and find me passed out with the book still open on my chest. So I've always loved looking for the extra stuff beyond just what they teach you in school in history. And I loved reading into things. So, if I saw something mentioned in a textbook, I would often say, this seems like an interesting person or an interesting event. And they would sometimes mention things that seemed, wait, is something else going on here? But they would just bat it off like it was nothing. And this would make me curious. So I would pull at these threads, and it would turn out that time after time, there would be so much stranger and more fascinating things that perhaps unsurprisingly aren't covered by state standards or not part of a typical curriculum. And it turns out that a lot of those were drug-related. I just kept noticing this theme of very big names using drugs and their drug use maybe being mentioned once or twice. Like, they'd say, oh, Sigmund Freud wrote this thing, Uber Coca. And I'm like, wait, like coca? Like cocaine? And sure enough, I looked it up, and he wrote this entire big thing about how great he thinks cocaine is. And they just skip right past that because there's so much other stuff to talk about.
Hmm. I guess that's part of what you were getting at in the introduction of the book when you said they, meaning some of these noteworthy historical figures, they were multifaceted individuals who led complicated, messy, often bizarre lives like we all do. And yet textbooks seldom tell you what inspired their successes or how they coped with their occasional failures. So as you have over the years, as a lover of history, read up on various people in history, this would be one of those themes that would kind of leap out at you. Speaking of the introduction, I want us to take a moment to talk about a question that you yourself essentially posed to the reader, and I suppose in a sense to yourself. Are drugs good or are they bad? And you go on to say, honestly, there is no one-size-fits-all answer to that question. I mean, in some ways, it's a little shocking to read those words at first, because I think a lot of times when we talk about drugs, are they good or bad? They're bad, because our minds immediately go to the ways in which drugs are abused and lead to ruin and all kinds of terrible, terrible things. And, of course, part of what your book is about is the way in which drugs, on occasion, maybe more often than we even realize, can serve human beings in very positive ways. I think that's what you're getting at there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like, it's very easy when we look at things in the news to hear drugs and think about things like people overdosing on fentanyl, or about methamphetamine or cocaine trafficking or other serious nasty things that result in people's death and despair and things like that. But at the same time, what drugs actually are, every time someone gets chemotherapy that cures their cancer, that's drugs. Every time someone drinks a cup of coffee that hasn't had the caffeine removed from it, that's drugs too. Anytime someone has a glass of white wine with their linguine and clams, I think that's a good combination. I haven't had it recently. that is drugs. So what drugs are is such a wide, wide category that it's easy to see how they've been demonized in ways that both people have demonized drug use, both for the sake of trying to keep people safe and also because it was politically useful to do so. So it's easy for us to think, oh, it's either bad, or to go all contrarian and then say, no, it's good, actually. But the reality is drugs are tools, and tools can be used for good or bad things, and it's not an inherent moral thing.
Right. And, of course, you also in the introduction point out something that I think really bears repeating and consideration. At one point you write, people often suffer serious harm that is related to drugs when they're not properly educated about the powerful effects and consequences of these drugs. The truth is,
yes,
many of these historical figures could have made much smarter choices if only they had known the facts. I mean, not to exactly give them a free pass, but the truth is that we are in many cases talking about figures in sometimes even the quite distant past in which little or nothing was understood about drugs and their long-lasting effects, the consequences, and so on. I mean, certainly that information was not available in the way that it is today.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And even surprisingly recently, it is amazing what simply was not common knowledge. Like nowadays, you know, we've heard all about the opioid epidemic, and so we know that people can start out being legitimately prescribed drugs by a doctor, but they can spiral into addiction and start abusing those drugs, and it can destroy lives and tear people apart. But someone like Elvis Presley is a great example of someone who got hooked on prescription drugs, and the whole time he didn't even realize that he was doing drugs, much less that he was a drug addict, because his viewpoint is, no, I got this from a doctor. A doctor wouldn't give me something that would hurt me. That's not what doctors do. They help you. But he didn't realize that, you know, he was taking prescription amphetamines and opioids and all kinds of pills that were much, much stronger than he would castigate people for smoking marijuana. He was a big anti-marijuana guy, Elvis Presley. But ironically, he didn't realize that at the same time, he was routinely popping much harder drugs. But he thought all of that was okay because it was a prescription. And then he ends up dying at age 40, in large part because of his overuse of those drugs. And the whole time, he never realized that it was hurting him because, in his mind, doctors don't hurt. They help.
Hmm. The ultimate cautionary tale. One last sort of preliminary question before we delve into some of the fascinating specific stories that are part of your book, Human History on Drugs. You mention in the introduction, which is why I'm going to mention it now, the fact that you are on the autism spectrum. And I'd like you to, you do a lovely job in the introduction of explaining why you make a point of telling the reader that. I wonder if you would share with our listeners the fact that you are on the autism spectrum, what that has to do with your life as a writer and an historian and as a lover of history. I think it really does speak to the sort of ferocious intensity with which you have explored all this.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'd be happy to share that. So obviously autism is used for a wide, again, it's a spectrum, right? So I have what they used to call high-functioning autism. Basically, I don't have any intellectual problems, but I do have, I get these very specific interests in the things, and I have a lot of sort of sensory reaction to the world around me that's very strong. And these kind of things combine in that a lot of people with autism, whether they have the kinds that are like mine, whether it manifests mostly as their personality, or if they have the kind that has an element of intellectual disability, a lot of these people will have very intense special interests. They will have certain fields that they absolutely love and can't get enough of, and will hyperfixate on and focus on them all the time. And I totally know that I have this tendency. And so what I like to do is to steer it into a positive thing by making it about learning. So history has always been one of my big hyperfixations, my special interest. And so it's an almost physical compulsion to just go out and collect interesting information and to learn more. And it's satisfying on a visceral level for me to learn these things and share them with others. And in large part, that is driven by that autistic special interest kind of motivator.
Right. And as to, in a sense, sort of quantify or concretize what you were just describing, towards the end of the introduction, you tell the reader that there is an appendix to this book in which, in your words, I list some of my sources, not all of them, of course, because otherwise the appendix would be longer than the book itself. I just love that idea, and I don't think you're exaggerating there. And I mean, you just think about the way in which a lot of books get written with only the most cursory, shallow sort of research versus this book, in which you have immersed yourself in the topic in a way that is truly astonishing.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of hard work and effort. I've been working on this book for 6 or 7 years now. And it definitely, like the selected bibliography, I believe is 35 pages long, single space. So it is, it was a lot of work. And so certainly I love what I do, but it is not true that if you love what you do, you will never work a day in your life. I have definitely worked a lot, but I'm satisfied with what I've done.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Sam Kelly about a fascinating book called Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. That subtitle makes, in a sense, glancing reference or passing reference to something that I'm sure is a tremendous temptation whenever anybody is writing a book like this, in which you are shining a light on kind of a fascinating aspect of the human condition, and that is the temptation to make it even more fascinating than it factually is. In other words, I'm sure on some level, even a serious historian wishes, you know, for certain outrageous or crazy stories to be true and to share them as though they are true. One of the things I appreciate about your book is we get a sense of tremendous honesty and integrity and clarity in the way that you have written this book and share these stories with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I do find that I can understand, certainly in this age where like clicks and engagement get people a lot of, it's a big motivator for a lot of people, that people would be tempted to embellish or exaggerate or make things seem even more elaborate and lurid than they really are, simply because they want to draw attention. But I think that's it's poisonous to the ultimate search for truth, and it actively damages the credibility of the if someone wants to be a real historian and not just a fun storyteller, then you have to resist the impulse to make things seem overly scandalous, because not only does it give people a false view of what the past was like, it also diminishes the fact that there are so many stories in here that are 100% true and yet seem so crazily over the top that if it was written as fiction, someone might not even believe it. So making sure that I don't exaggerate things is a way to help the things that are really extreme and really shocking stand out even more, because, no, this is actually what happened.
Right, and it's told within the context of, this is most certainly true. I mean, you can believe what I am telling you now, versus other books that, in a sense, are more fancifully written, in which you don't know what to believe or what exactly is true. One of the things that I think may surprise some people is that even though the title is Human History on Drugs, I think a lot of people might jump to the conclusion that this is going to be largely a recent history. But in fact, the part one of the book is titled Ancient Potions. And you indeed take us back to the ancient world in a couple of different ways. There are six chapters here. The one I think I would have us focus on is Alexander the Great, in part because not too long on this program, I aired an interview with someone who had written quite a fascinating book about Alexander the Great. But the title of this chapter is Alexander the Great Was a Sloppy Drunk. And that is probably not something that any of us have ever read in our own history books. Tell us about this aspect of Alexander the Great, and also why it is helpful to know this in terms of understanding him and what he accomplished better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I think that obviously his substance use excess doesn't get focused on as much, but a lot of people know that Alexander the Great was someone who could never get enough of anything. I mean, he spent his entire adult life in conquest, conquered half the known world. And it's also known that he was quite a libidinous individual. He liked many pretty ladies and men, and he wasn't very picky. He enjoyed the physical pleasures of life. And one of those things that he enjoyed was he really liked to drink and do opium. I mean, he worked hard, but he played hard. He was a party animal. And what he drank was, he drank what was called unwatered wine. And back at this time, of course, there wasn't the same refrigeration or freshness technology that we had today to keep our drinks cold and good. So a lot of time, cask-strength wine was as strong as hard alcohol is today and was only watered down to be more similar to what we would consider wine when it was time to serve. See, Alexander the Great would drink unwatered wine, not out of cups, but out of bowls. He would drink bowl after bowl of wine to celebrate victories, celebrating conquests of land and of people. And he really liked to celebrate by drinking. And he also, both because of his constant engagements in combat and also because of the euphoric effects thereof, he also liked to use opium as both a recreational and medical drug, which he would combine with alcohol, just making him even more whacked out. So this is someone who has a really big appetite for substances, and it ends up he loses control sometimes. At one point, he had a friend who had saved him in battle, but while he was hammered drunk, he argued with this friend, and he killed him. And then when he regained his senses afterwards, he was horrified by what he'd done, but it showed that even someone who seemed to have enough control to lead his armies like this and to conquer whole areas, he couldn't even stop himself from killing someone he loved while he was under the influence. And in the end, he died at age 32, not because he ever lost a battle. He was not killed in battle. The battle he lost was against himself. He was going back to Greece. He and his troops were partying in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Baghdad, and he consumed so much wine and opium that he became very ill and had to go to bed. He was delirious for a few days and then died, and it seems pretty clear that while some rumored he'd been poisoned, it seems pretty clear that he had basically destroyed his body's defenses by getting so drunk and so opiated, and then some kind of disease that he got during his travels would have been easily able to kill him then.
Hmm. I guess that's why you call him at one point the most notorious party animal in all of ancient Greece. I do want to ask you real quick, at one point as you were describing Alexander the Great and the kind of wine, the nature of the wine that he would happily consume, you tell us that, and I think you maybe already touched on this a bit, that the alcoholic concentration was as high as 40%. I'm just curious, how is it that we can know something like that? I mean, all of these centuries later, where does one find information of that nature?
So it helps that that from that time period, there have been, archaeologists have actually recovered wine casks from ancient Greece and found that they've done analyses of trace amounts of materials found inside them. Some still have like the preserved sulfites. And so they've been able to run, using science that I admit that I don't fully understand, they've been able to run studies that showed that these were extremely high concentration alcoholic beverages being stored in these containers that they ended up finding in ancient Greek sites.
Hmm. We're speaking with Sam Kelly about his book, Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. Again, the book begins with a chapter or a section titled Ancient Potions, 6 chapters in all, and it ranges around various parts of the globe from ancient Greece to ancient Egypt to ancient China. Part 2 of the book is called Medieval Highs, and I would love to spend a few minutes talking about one of the most famous figures of that era, namely playwright William Shakespeare. And the title of this chapter, chapter 8, is William Shakespeare Was a Stoner. Just plain and simple. So tell us more about William Shakespeare's interest in certain mind-altering drugs and to what extent they were actually a really significant part of his daily life.
Yes, so absolutely. So Shakespeare is a subject of some historical contention. Some people argue, oh, well, maybe he didn't write all the stuff he said he did. Maybe some other people wrote it. But there are definite known facts about Shakespeare. So we know about when he lived. We know where he lived. There's his house in Stamford-upon-Avon that's now a major tourist site. And in the backyard of his very home, where he'd been living, they found pipes buried in the backyard, and when they dated them back to the period when he was living there, and they were encrusted with cannabis and tobacco from that time period. So that apparently was something that he would just do in his backyard. And if you look in his work, you can start to see that there is clear evidence that he knows about altered states of being and is sort of winking and nodding at them without explicitly saying what we are. Like, there's a whole bit in A Midsummer Night's Dream where the characters are given what is called a love potion that is extracted from the juice of some flower. And the description of what happens to them after they consume it, they're all trippy and blissed out and feeling the love. Pretty clearly sounds like they're in an opium-fueled reverie, but he just didn't explicitly say it was opium. And similarly, he talks about things in other works, like he has one sonnet where he actually refers to seeking inspiration in a noted weed that can make you perceive things in different ways and things like that. But he never outright goes and says, yes, I'm doing drugs, because he didn't want to lose the approval of the highest classes.
Hmm. Fascinating. And, of course, William Shakespeare is one of those figures that's already fascinating, but this just adds to the sense of mystique about this great artist.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And just one little quick thing to add. Also, once you see that Shakespeare was known for making up like hundreds of words and just adding them to the English language like it was the most natural thing in the world and they were already there, it makes a little more sense that he would have so much love for creating his own words when you realize he was a little bit high sometimes when he was coming up with those words.
Hmm. The third part of the book is titled Colonial Chaos. And we are treated to some very interesting stories about George Washington and Andrew Jackson and Andrew Johnson. So
absolutely.
Three of our presidents from the late 18th, early 19th century. I was really surprised to see George Washington's name here, and especially after seeing the title of that chapter, which is George Washington's Terrible Teeth. And I think a lot of us have at least the vague notion that George Washington had some sort of teeth issues and wore a kind of denture that probably most
Very
of us would...
Dentures.
Yes, but you tell us a lot more about those false teeth of our first president and then tie into why such a story belongs in a book about drug use. Explain the nature of President Washington's false teeth and why the use of drugs was all but a necessity.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we always see in pictures of George Washington, he is never cracking a smile. You never see that he always looks kind of awkward and uncomfortable, and his mouth is always, and of course that's because his dentures were so primitive that they didn't properly fit in his mouth. I mean, a lot of the time we hear a whitewashed version that George Washington had wooden teeth. That is not the case. He wishes he had wooden teeth. The actual truth was much, much worse. It was a combination of most of them were teeth taken actually from real people. Some of them were taken from corpses. Some of them were taken from enslaved people that he owned. And a few of them had animal teeth mixed in there, like cow's teeth. They were crudely wired together with metal and then attached to the one remaining real tooth in his entire mouth. So the whole thing was a Frankenstein nightmare of bone and machinery that had been jammed into his face, and it put him in constant pain, but without teeth, he couldn't talk properly, which was a big problem for someone who's supposed to be leading a revolutionary war and then later a nation. So he had to have these teeth in order to be able to conduct his business, but it hurt so much to have the, again, dentures makes these things sound more advanced than they were. This abomination of dentures, to have it in his mouth, he had to be taking opium on a regular basis so he wasn't in blinding pain. Mm. And this was what his doctor told him to do. It wasn't seen as something that was they figured you will not be a functional person if you don't have some kind of painkiller to deal with your teeth, but you need your teeth in order to be a leader. So to be a leader, we are going to have to give you opium on a regular basis.
Wow. Amazing. The chapter about Andrew Jackson is just as interesting, and the title of that chapter is Andrew Jackson Was a Mean, Crazy, Racist Drunk. Actually, I can't read my handwriting. What's the last word? Andrew Jackson.
There's a murderous in there.
Murderous drunk. That's right. That's right, because you tell us in this chapter that Andrew Jackson fought in more than 100 duels to his life. But the point I want us to just explore for a moment is something really intriguing you say towards the end of this chapter, when you say some people basically are altered by their drinking. I mean, drinking turns them into somebody else. And you say not Andrew Jackson. If anything, drinking simply made him more Andrew Jackson. That's a really interesting notion, and he's not probably the one and only person in human history about which this is true. But in what way would you say this was true for Andrew Jackson? In what way did his heavy drinking, in a sense, allow him or free him to be even more himself?
Absolutely. So yeah, Andrew Jackson was just a terrifying human being. Like, by nature, he was incredibly quick to anger, hence him fighting in over 100 duels. He would often respond to any slights to his honor with extreme violence. He was a racist. He especially he was a slave owner and had a special hatred for the Native American people, hence why he was responsible for the Trail of Tears. And so this is someone who is already very angry, very volatile, very ready to respond with violence. And you know, even in a best-case scenario, he's going to be volatile and probably going to curse people out a lot. Andrew Jackson had a pet parrot, and the pet parrot was invited to his funeral originally, but they had to disinvite the parrot because the parrot wouldn't stop swearing because, of course, it was Andrew Jackson's parrot. Drinking heavily just made – it exacerbated all those traits. Like, any kind of – he already had very, very few inhibitions against engaging in violence, but – the drinking would kind of take most of those away. It would encourage him to be even wilder and over the top. And similarly, when he decided to just defy orders that he'd been given, it strongly encouraged his devil-may-care attitude.
Fascinating. We should say that also in this section of the book, you tell the fairly well-known story of our 17th president, Andrew Johnson, and how he was quite drunk on the day in 1865 when he was sworn in as our vice president. And this was not just a one-day affair, but this was a theme of much of his adult life, which you tell us about. But I think we need to forge ahead to the fourth section of the book, which is titled Victorian Decadence. And I want us to take a moment to talk about somebody who will be a little less familiar name than some of the others we've talked about, one Samuel Taylor Coleridge, a very, very talented writer whose son was a very talented composer. But this is an interesting chapter because this is one of the best examples we find of someone where the use of some kind of controlled substance, in his case, laudanum, seems to have been a source of relief and a source of creative inspiration. Tell us more about how this figured in the artistic life of Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Okay, yeah, that's a great one. So Samuel Taylor Coleridge is an interesting figure in that he is sort of a prototypical image of the Victorian addict artist. Like, he is someone who, on one hand, is considered to be both brilliant at literary analysis and at writing itself. Not only did he produce famous works like Kubla Khan, which, of course, is the work written about in the book, but also he's very well known in some circles for – he helped repopularize Hamlet. Like, a lot of Shakespearean plays that had kind of fallen into disuse, he gave a lecture series that was very influential in getting people to reevaluate works that they'd previously seen as, like, confusing revenge dramas, as elaborate, you know, psychosocial stories that closely examine the human condition. So on one hand, he's clearly this deep thinker, but on the other hand, he spends almost all his time drinking laudanum. And laudanum is opium that is suspended, like, made drinkable in alcohol. It's opium and alcohol mixed together. And during his time, you could just buy that at any pharmacy in Britain over the counter. Just walk into any corner shop, you could buy it, give it to your kids or whatever, and that was legal back then. So he ends up going into a reverie, drinking so much laudanum, and he has this dream, this extraordinary dream. And when he wakes up, he starts writing it down. And he has this vision about this beautiful epic poem it's going to be. But then while he's in the middle of writing it, there's a knock on the door, and he gets interrupted, and he has to go deal with I'm not sure if it's a salesman or what, and frankly, it seems like he was too high to really understand what the person wanted. But by the time he came back, the dream he'd had left his head. He didn't remember the words he wanted to write anymore, and he spends most of the rest of his life trying to re-remember that, and eventually just publishes it as it is. and that's Kubla Khan, and it's considered one of his best works. But we have no idea how he intended it for it to end. It was supposed to be much longer.
Fascinating. This section of the book is so interesting. One story after another, including Queen Victoria herself, as well as the great painter Vincent van Gogh and the great Sigmund Freud. But I think it would be very timely if we spend our time talking for the next couple of minutes about the gentleman whose story is told in Chapter 14, the Pope who loved cocaine wine. And that Pope happens to be Pope Leo the 13th. And if I'm not mistaken, our newest Pope took the name Leo, at least in part because of the legacy of this particular Pope. Although I'm pretty sure this exact facet of Pope Leopold the 13th is not something that our current Pope particularly admired. Maybe he doesn't even have any awareness of. But what is the story of this cocaine wine that was enjoyed by Pope Leo the 13th?
So yeah, this is a truly fascinating story. So the current Pope Leo is Pope Leo the 14th. So he in fact directly picked the name the previous Pope Leo, Pope Leo the 13th, had made so well known. And so Pope Leo the 13th was an Italian guy from a well-off family. He becomes Pope in his late 70s in the 19th century, so it's the 1800s. And again, the 1800s is a very different time in terms of drug laws. Like I said, when Samuel Taylor Coleridge was buying all that laudanum, none of that was illegal. And so at this time, cocaine wine was a completely legal beverage. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It is wine that has had cocaine infused into it, so it gives it has the properties of both. And this was sold in stores as a health tonic. It was considered to be good for you. It was originally developed by an Italian guy whose last name was Mariani, and so he called it Vin Mariani. And this stuff was popular worldwide. Like Queen Victoria drank it, Ulysses S. Grant drank it, Thomas Edison drank it. So it was very popular among all kinds of famous people. And the Pope was actually one of those people himself. And again, the Pope, when Pope Leo XIII was in power, he was in his late 70s, in his 80s, and 90s. And yet he's known for being incredibly productive and prolific, to the point where in the entire history of the Catholic Church, I think there's been about 300 encyclicals, and Pope Leo XIII wrote about 80 of them. This is someone who has incredible, incredible dedication to theology and energy for it. He writes all these things about denouncing the excesses of both communism and capitalism and talking about the importance of a middle way. And how is he doing this? As he says himself, he drinks the cocaine wine, quote, to fortify myself when prayer is insufficient. He loved it so much, he gave a Vatican gold medal to the creator of the cocaine wine, the Mariani guy, and then he appeared in a full-page advertisement for Vin Mariani, which is actually reproduced inside the book. So the Pope himself directly endorsed, in a full-page ad, a cocaine-infused wine and said it was what helped him do his job as the Holy Father.
Amazing. And if all that weren't amazing enough, we also, by the end of this chapter, learn a little bit about the origins of Coca-Cola. But we are leaving that to our listeners to explore on their own. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Sam Kelly about his amazing and fascinating book called Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. And I trust that we are giving our listeners a good sense of how much there is in this book that we are not able to take the time to talk about. We are just skimming the surface. In part five, titled Wartime Fogginess, you talk about an interesting array of people from Adolf Hitler to Audie Murphy. In the chapter about Adolf Hitler, I really learned something that I had never known before. I had known that Hitler had in his background some drug usage, but I had not ever heard before the origins of that. And that origin dates back to the First World War and Hitler's military service. explain the connection between those two things.
Absolutely. So like I said, cocaine was in the 19th century, cocaine had been very popular just generally. At this point, they were recognizing more that, okay, cocaine can be kind of addictive, but we still think this is a really great stimulant. And so when World War I came about and it was realized that they were going to be putting soldiers into horrible, dispiriting conditions in which they would have to constantly be alert and awake and would have to rely on less food and less sleep than usual, they were trying to figure out, well, how do we get our soldiers to do more with less? And Germany had the idea of giving its soldiers cocaine. A lot of militaries at the time did this, but Germany was the one that Adolf Hitler was serving in. And so Adolf Hitler, during World War I, became a very enthusiastic user of the cocaine that was supplied by his military superiors. And he, again, he was already a terrifying, terrifying person. But as he recorded, he said that he had some of the most fun in his life when he was fighting in World War I, doing cocaine as people died and were killed by chemical weapons left and right. So this is sort of the environment in which he gets really enthusiastic about drugs.
Hmm. The next chapter is titled Showbiz Blues. And you tell the stories of, among others, Howard Hughes, Judy Garland, Andy Warhol, Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley. And by the way, Elvis Presley's own history of drug use also began with his military service in the late 1950s and, of course, swelled drastically out of control in a really tragic fashion. As I read this part of the book, it occurred to me that you probably could have written an entire book only about this, that is, about well-known performers, artists, and so on, who, for one reason or another, succumbed to serious drug use. I'm just curious to know why you ended up choosing these particular stories, six in all, to focus on in terms of this wide canvas of drug use within show business. How did you know to go after these particular stories? What made them especially compelling?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question, because you're totally right. There is enough material here to write a whole another book. And I definitely had to cut down a lot of these. The entries that made it into the book had to be cut in length by like half, just to get it at the same length as other ones. I couldn't include everything. So the ones that I chose here, I felt were a bunch of really good examples of both. I felt that these were people from across a number of different backgrounds who used different drugs and had a wide range of effects. So I thought this was a good way to say, yes, in these spheres, there's a lot of people who use drugs, but these are all distinct cases that went slightly differently, and you can kind of draw, there's different tones and different feelings and themes for each of them, and certainly I feel that the sense of variety, but also the sense that I didn't want to tell too similar of stories too many times. That was part in how I selected these specific individuals. There are other people who I could write chapters on, but, you know, hey, maybe that's for, you know, knock on wood, another book.
Right. Well, I think the choices you made were quite interesting. And even when we are visiting a story that we already know fairly well, for instance, the story, the tragic story of Judy Garland, nevertheless, I feel like I learned a great deal about her story and her sad descent into increasing drug use. Same with Elvis Presley, again, a well-known story. And you posed this intriguing question towards the end of his chapter, in describing how much his drug use worsened. Why didn't anyone help him? Because he was surrounded by relentless enablers whose goal was to keep him performing rather than keep him healthy. Well, we go on to other interesting chapters to fill out the book, including the seventh section, Counterculture Mayhem, in which we learn, among other things, the interesting story of Ken Kesey and some of the tests that he voluntarily underwent in the late 50s, taking LSD so scientists could study exactly what LSD did. And the fact that he experienced this at that point in his life changed the trajectory of where he would go on from there. But the last section of the book, Modern Mystics, begins with Carl Sagan and ends with Steve Jobs. We just have a minute or two left, but I wonder if you could explain to our listeners why the founder, co-founder of Apple is in this book.
So Steve Jobs said it himself. He described doing LSD as one of the two or three most important things he'd done in his life. And if I remember correctly, he said that in a security clearance declaration to the U.S. government. I mean, in order to get approved for some of the high-level work that Apple was doing, he had to admit, while getting a security clearance, what drugs have you done? And so Steve Jobs openly admitted that not only had he consumed a lot of marijuana back in the day, he also said that he'd used LSD several times and said that he thought it was a profoundly transformative and positive experience for him. And it seems like it certainly helped him in terms of that he was mostly an idea and design guy. Like, he wasn't so much of a nitty-gritty coder, but he was a big guy on presentation and ideas. And so the LSD was one factor in why Apple adopted the graphical user interface when they didn't create it, but the creators of it said, should we put, like, pictures of things? Like, should we put a trash can when you want to throw away a file? Should we have that? And they're like, no, that's too kiddie and gimmicky. It'll never catch on. But Steve Jobs, with his acid, you know, modified brain, he looks at this and says, no, this is brilliant. It's like a whole world inside the computer screen. And this will be a thing that revolutionizes how people see using a computer. It'll make it feel so much more real. And it turns out that adopting that idea that more sober-minded people had rejected turned out to be very profitable for him.
Hmm. Fascinating. Well, as I said, we have just scratched the surface in terms of all that is in this book that I think is 400 pages long, and as we've already mentioned, includes an extensive bibliography and source notes to help us understand how you have come to know all of this about this wide array of people from human history. The book, again, is Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence, published by Plume, an imprint of Penguin Random House. The author, Sam Kelly. Sam Kelly, congratulations on a fantastic book. I enjoyed it so much, and I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed being here.
The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that the program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And don't forget the podcast version of The Morning Show. To enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today we have cloudy skies with showers ending a bit later this morning, headed for a high of 62 degrees. Mostly cloudy overnight with a low of 53 degrees. An air quality alert goes into effect due to the effect of the Canadian wildfires. We should have sunshine returning on Thursday with high temperatures in the 60s. A slight chance of rain on Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.